Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Brait's financial year audited results for the year ended 31 March 2022. All participants will be in listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity to ask questions when prompted. If you should need assistance during the call, please signal an operator by pressing star and then zero. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I'd now like to hand the conference over to Mr. Peter Hayward-Butt. Please go ahead, sir.
Thanks very much, Judith. And thanks very much to our shareholders and other stakeholders who've taken the time to join us today. We've got quite a few slides to get through. You'll note they're all up on the Brait website. So I probably won't give enough credit to each slide. I will try and get through most of them within an hour and leave ourselves some time for Q&A at the end of that. So moving on to the first slide in terms of the year in review. It's been a very pleasing year, to be honest, in different ways for different portfolio companies. But I think overall it's been a pleasing year in terms of progress. From a Virgin Active perspective, it was a very significant year for Virgin. I think we look back as to how much has been done over the course of the last 12 months. It was a huge amount, and I think it's really set a platform for this business to continue to grow. For those who would remember, we completed the restructuring plan in May 2021, which resulted in $134 million of liquidity savings for the business. We then did debt refinancings at both Virgin Active South Africa and the VA International business. We raised about £88 million of capital for the business at the beginning of this year, which closed in March, and we appointed new management, not just the CEO of the business, Dean Kowalski, but Mark Field as the CFO, and more recently Jessica Spira, who's joined us as the Virgin Active South Africa MD. So a significant amount of progress in the business, and it's very pleasing to see the positive momentum that we're starting to see across the various territories from a membership perspective. The revised strategy, which we'll talk a bit about later, will give you an indication of, you know, what our strategy is, where's the market at the moment, and where do we see it going, and how do we play into that space. And particularly, as you'll see when we go through the presentation, the acquisition of the Real Foods Nutrition assets, Kauai and New, will definitely help accelerate the shift from Virgin Active from being a pure physical fitness business into the broader wellness space. From a Premier perspective, we'll get into numbers later, but a very, very pleasing performance both, as I mentioned, on an absolute basis, EBITDA up 36%, but also on a relative basis relative to the peers in the market. And this has been driven by a broad number of things, to be honest, market share growth across just about every category, volume growth, and we've managed to pass, or the company's managed to pass input costs through in price increases and very significant cost management, and we're starting to see the benefit of operational leverage come into the business. So we'll touch a bit on that later. The Mr. Sweets deal completed in June, which was a positive and is added to this year's performance for the last 10 months. And we have completed the IPO readiness. As anyone knows, there's probably a 6 to 9 month lag to list a business. We have now completed that. We are in a position to be able to progress a listing, so should we so choose. It's definitely still on the cards. I heard some market commentator say, thinking it may not be, but we're under no pressure to do so, and we will choose the right window to do so. So the company is ready to list, and we will do so when market conditions permit. From a new look perspective, the operational and financial benefits that have started to come through from the restructuring of the business, as you remember, that went through two CVAs over the last 18 months, really have set a solid platform for growth. The business was doing fantastically well up until October last year. Obviously, Omicron in the October to December quarter impacted significantly on this business, as did some of the supply chain issues, and we'll again try and unpack that later in the presentation. The good news is the business has had a very good start to the year. Its year end is March. The first couple of months of the year have been very positive, and hopefully that will remain on track for the rest of the year. We also managed to sell the Consol business for a total valuation of 10.7 billion rand. The benefit of that from a Brait perspective was just over 400 million, and those proceeds were received in May and will be used to repay the existing RCF. From a Brait perspective, we completed the exchangeable bond issuance in December, which removed any liquidity constraints on the business. And as I mentioned when I was talking a bit about Premier, it's given us the flexibility in terms of timing the asset monetization in a basis that will make most sense and add most value to our shareholders. The strategy remains to unlock value for shareholders over the next 3 years. We have a slide at the end of this deck setting that out as our plan A. Clearly, there may be different plans that come between now and then, but what we've set out is our basis that we're working towards to realize value for shareholders over the next 3 years. From an NAV perspective, it increased by 6% from 790 to 837, and hopefully we're now in a position, particularly with respect to Virgin Active, to see some growth in that business going forward. I won't touch on the ESG slide. There's lots and lots and lots of things that have happened across the portfolio companies, very positive. I've touched on a couple of them on this slide that you see in front of you. But if you go to the Ethos website, there's a very, very detailed ESG report, and it really does do a lot of credit to these companies and their management teams for the amount of work that they have done to position themselves on the ESG spectrum. Moving on to the NAV and liquidity, I'll let Sabelo talk to that in a bit more detail.
Thanks, Peter, and good afternoon, everyone. Starting with slide 8, Brait's audited NAV per share of R8.37 represents an increase of 3% for the six-month period compared to interim September NAV of R8.14 and a 6% increase in for the financial year. Total assets of $18.7 billion is weighted 49% Premier, 44% Virgin Active, 4% New Look, 2% other investments, and 1% cash. Total liabilities of $7.7 billion comprise Brait's $3 billion committed borrowing facility due 30 June 2024, referred to as the BML RCF, which is drawn at reporting date by $2.5 billion. The £150 million convertible bonds due 4 December 2024 are valued in terms of IFRS at $2.7 billion, and the $3 billion exchangeable bonds issued by subsidiary BIH, which are due 3 December 2024, and valued in terms of IFRS at $2.4 billion. Accounts payable of $166 million largely comprises of the accrual of coupons on these two bond instruments. Resulting NAV is $11.1 billion, which equates to R8.37 per share. To note, there are two disclosure changes shown in the audited FY22 IFRS financial statement, neither of which have any impact on the group's key NAV per share reporting metric. The first stems from the fact that Brait is no longer legally required to use the euro as a second presentation currency to the rand, following its redomiciliation from Malta to Mauritius. The second arises from the group's immediate subsidiary company, BIH, having issued the $3 billion exchangeable bond in the current year. In terms of IFRS 10, this has led to the change in classification to BIH's investment entity status. As a result, with effect from 1 October 2021, the group is exempted from consolidation, with the audited financial statements reflecting the fair value of the investment in BIH as opposed to the look-through consolidation method that applied in the past. We have included slides in the appendix section of the results booklet to unpack the effect of this change in the presentation of the audited balance sheet, income statement, and cash flow statement. Importantly, it has no impact in the calculation of the group's audited NAV per share. Over to slide 9, which sets an overview of the NAV movements for the financial year. To note that at the outset that the peer groups for Premier, Virgin Active, and New Look remain unchanged. Premier is valued at reporting date on a post-IFRS 16 basis. The valuation slide on the deck sets out for comparative purposes the metrics on a pre-IFRS 16 basis for the carrying value of $9.3 billion. Virgin Active and New Look valuation metrics are quoted on a pre-IFRS 16 basis. Premier's carrying value increased by 22% from $7.6 billion to $9.3 billion. The main driver of the increase in carrying value is maintainable EBITDA, which is based on Premier's last 12 months achieved EBITDA of $1.5 billion. The valuation multiple of 7.6 times is a 1% discount to the peer average LTM multiple of 7.7 times. Net debt of $2 billion excludes capex of $370 million, largely spent on the recently commissioned Pretoria Mill and Bakery. Brait's equity participation in Premier post-dilution for management incentive scheme is 96.5%. Virgin Active's carrying value increased 4% from $8 billion to $8.3 billion. Maintainable EBITDA is based on a look-through to a two-year forward post-coronavirus sustainable level of £110 million. The unchanged two-year forward valuation multiple of 9x is a 10% discount to the peer group's average of 10x. Net third party debt of £380 million includes a £27 million normalization adjustment for the estimated effect of working capital and cost deferred during lockdown period. Following Virgin Active's £88 million capital raise that concluded in March this year, Braith's equity and shareholder funding participation has decreased from 80 to 71%. New Look's carrying value increased by 23% from £545 million to £672 million. Maintainable EBITDA is based on a sustainable level of £55 million. The one-year forward valuation multiple of 5x represents a 25% discount to the peer group's average of 6.7x. Net debt of £79 million includes a £30 million normalization adjustment for estimated deferred costs. Braith's equity participation in New Look is unchanged at 17.4%. Other investments, meanwhile, increased by 29% to £437 million as a result of uplift in Braith's remaining private equity investments, mostly relating to Braith 4's investment in Consul, which is valued at reporting date based on the concluded sale agreement with ARDAC. Turning to page 10, the $1 billion decrease in the drawn BML RCF comprises the $2.9 billion repayment using the net proceeds from the issuance of the BIH exchangeable bond in December 2021, which is offset by $1.7 billion investment in Virgin Active and $252 million interest accrual at the facility rate of Driver Plus 4. Slide 11 analyzes Braith's liquidity and debt. In terms of liquidity, the opening cash balance as at 1 April 2021 was $213 million. Braith then received $234 million proceeds from the investment portfolio, mostly comprising $173 million shareholder funding repayments by Premier and the final $50 million deferred realization proceeds from the sale of DGB in March 2020, which in terms of the agreement were received on the due date of 31 March 2022. Total expenses paid during the year were $207 million. Purchase of investments of $1.7 billion all relate to Virgin Active and largely comprises advances of shareholder funding as set out in footnote 1 on the slide. Braith received net proceeds of $2.934 billion from the issuance of the BIH exchangeable bonds in December 2021, which were used to repay part of the BML RCF. Net cash outflow from financing activities of $1.4 billion relates to a net $1.1 billion drawn from the BML RCF during the year, together with $200 million coupons paid on the 2024 convertible bonds and $135 million interest serviced on the BML RCF. The resulting group closing cash balance at reporting date is $83 million. In terms of borrowings at reporting date, the BML RCF's facility limit is $3 billion with a term date of 30 June 2024. The drawn level of $2.5 billion results in an available facility of $532 million, which together with group cash of $83 million gives available liquidity at reporting date of $615 million. Including the $402 million proceeds that arise from the sale of Consul, available liquidity post balance sheet date is 1 billion rand. Braith is in compliance with all debt covenants on the BML RCF and on the 2024 convertible bond. Thank you, and over to you, Peter.
Thanks, Sibela. So let's turn to some of the portfolio companies, and starting with Premier. As I mentioned, Premier's had a fantastic performance, and credit must go to Kurvis, Fritz, and the entire team at Premier. It's easy to take credit for it sitting in front of the phone, but those guys have spent a huge amount of time, and this is not over the last 12 months, but probably over the last 3 to 4 years, getting this business into shape to reflect the results that they do today. As you can see, revenue for the year up 16% to 14.5 billion rand. Adjusted EBITDA up 36% year on year to 1.5 billion rand. And equally impressive, a 47% increase in EBIT for the year. So showing the operational leverage in the business. One of the questions I was asked today is, what's the basis for that performance? And I do think it's a couple of things. It's the culture in the business that has been focused on cost management and growing the business over the last 3 or 4 years. It's the historic capex that's been spent over many, many years, nearly 5 billion rand over the last 10 years, and a significant chunk of that over the last 3 to 4 years. And then it's obviously M&A. I think obviously Mr. Sweets played a key role in that of late, but there's been a number of transactions over the last 3 to 4 years which have all been additive overall to the growth. So a 47% increase in EBIT with a margin of 6.9% up from 5.5% and an EBITDA margin of 10.3% versus 8.8% at this time last year. As I mentioned, the integration of Mr. Sweets has been completed. I would say 80 to 90% of the synergies have been realized already, and that's on track to start delivering that in this financial year. And very pleasingly, we commissioned the first line of the new Pretoria Bakery and the second line relatively soon. And we'll touch again on that in a bit more detail later on, but I think it will be a game changer for our inland strategy in the bread business. Probably most pleasing to me anyway is the adjusted return on invested capital increasing from 11.5% a year ago to 14.8%. which we think is in excess of our cost of equity for the first time. In terms of the business itself, and I won't dwell too much on the slide, but I think if you had to say in a nutshell what is Premier about and why is it performing well, it has got a strong and increasing market share across almost all of its categories, which I think is important. So we spent a huge amount of time talking about Millbake, but I think all categories have performed well over the last probably 2 to 3 years, but certainly over the last 12 months. It's got a national footprint of integrated milling and baking operations. And the important point there being integrated, having them on the same site results in massive operational efficiencies and enables you to get the operational efficiencies and margins that we've seen come through over the last 12 to 18 months. Very strong brands in various categories and own label products, which we do for our customers. And then distribution, particularly in the informal space, is a massive barrier to entry. And I think if you look at all of those, that would say in a nutshell, why this business continues to be something that we believe is a great business, will continue to be a good business, and still has latent growth, which we can touch on later in the presentation. Moving to the performance of Millbake itself, we've shown the results back to 2020 and 21 and 22, 15% growth in CAGR over that period of time. And very importantly, that has been driven by volume and price. We'll talk a bit about that below. And if you look at the adjusted EBITDA, up 23% over those 2 years, with the margin going from 10% to 12% in Millbake to just under $1.4 billion, that represents a fantastic result for this business. And it's demonstrated its ability to pass on input price increases whilst protecting and growing volumes and margins, which I think, dealing with all those three legs of the stool are pretty impressive, and credit to the management team. So, again, if you go back over a couple of years, from 2019 to 20, 9% increase in revenue that was driven largely by price increases of 5.9% and 3% volume growth. From 20 to 21, volume growth consisted of 7.8% with 8.7% of price growth, resulting in a 16% growth in revenue. And over the last 12 months, a relatively even spread, 6 and 6.5% between volume growth and price growth, resulting in a 12.5% increase in revenue. So a fantastic result, EBITDA up 32% for the year, with margins expanding by about 170 basis points to 12% over the last 12 months. But as I said, it hasn't just been a Millbake story. The groceries and international business, again, over the last 2 years, have seen CAGRs in revenue of 16% and in EBITDA of 16%. Margins relatively flat across that period of time, despite some relatively significant cost increases coming through across various categories. And I think this has been driven by, very, very significant historic CapEx spend. We seem to forget the fact that we've spent the money before. We're starting to see the benefits of that come through. We don't think we've seen all of the benefits of that come through, but this is something that's been 2 to 3 years in the making. And the brand loyalty and product expansion over that time, really have added to the bottom line. Sugar confectionery revenue increased by 238%, although obviously flattered by the Mr. Sweet acquisition. Mr. Sweet's moved the business to a number two in the category. We'll talk a bit about it later, and its numbers are included for 10 months of this financial year. Beverages were relatively small in our lives, but somewhat disappointing, decreased by 6% over the course of the last 12 months. But the home personal care business increased by 6%, which was pleasing in a very, very tough environment, and our Mozambique business managed to increase revenue also in a different operating environment by 10.4%. And this resulted in an increase in EBITDA to $200 million, which is an increase of 24% year on year. Again, what I think is a fantastic result. Not dwelling on this slide on page 17, it's just a function of all of them, but as you can see, the operational leverage coming through in the business, 16% revenue growth corresponds to 36% EBITDA growth, which corresponds to 47% increase in EBIT for the business. From a working capital and cash flow perspective, just to pick up a couple of points, there was quite a big swing at the end of March around working capital. You would have seen a positive movement in 21 of $220 million to a negative movement in working capital at the 31st of March. That largely unwound by the end of the, well, first couple of weeks of April, but from an accounting perspective, there was a relatively big swing of, call it, nearly $300 million in working capital. From a maintenance capex perspective, we spent about $186 million. Capex total for the year was $519 million, 519, of which $333 million was expansionary capex, largely the Pretoria Bakery, which was commissioned, as I mentioned, in March 2022. This doesn't include the $419 million rand that we spent on the Mr. Sweet acquisition, which was funded by internally generated cash and cash on the balance sheet. From a free cash flow perspective, free cash flow conversion was 67%, down from 97% last year, and that's predominantly as a result of the working capital swings in the business. Just touching on how the sectors perform generally, I know a number of our competitors put a couple of slides out. We believe, and we've seen over a number of years, that bread has shown a really consistent real growth performance since, if you go all the way back to 2017, and to be honest, before that as well. We didn't choose 2017 as a particular year. It just happened to be 5 years ago, in a highly, highly defensive sector. So we've seen CAGRs of 7% since 2017. That has continued in 21 into 22, and we think is likely to continue going forward. Our formal market shares, our premier has grown from 2021 to 22 from 24% odd to north of 26%. And we've also seen, and very pleasingly seen, good growth in the informal market, which people must remember is 60% of our bread is sold into the informal space. The newly commissioned Pretoria Bakery, we believe, will grow, continue to drive earnings growth. We only commissioned that, as I mentioned, in March. So we started in April, the second line, probably in the next month or so, and then that will be up and running. We think it will only contribute fully probably in next year's results, but certainly it will start to contribute the back end of this year, financial 23 results. From that perspective, operational efficiencies and consolidation of our premier operations inland, you know, really will put that business, or that part of our business, on the, hopefully the same trajectory and margins as our coastal bakeries. And again, I'll touch a bit on that later. From maize, wheat, and baking products perspective, so the milling side of the business, again, decent volume growth pretty much since 2019. The market share for Premier has grown from 18.5% to 20.3%, and in maize from 8.9% to 9.9%. So again, across both categories, we've seen market share gains and very, very significant cost savings and operational efficiencies coming through as this part of the business. There's massive operational leverage in this type of business, and despite the increased price and volatility we've seen in weight and wheat and maize, the business has done a great job, and we'll talk again a bit about that later, of passing that on in a considered manner to ensure that our margins and growth are protected. In the non-millbag products part of the business, again, from a sugar confectionery perspective, back to 2017, it's about 9% CAGR. We think it's a category that will continue to grow. We are now number two as Premier. We have a 17.4% market share in this business, and we're starting to see the extraction of significant operational synergies and costs coming out of the Mr. Sweet business with our confectionery business. From a personal care and feminine care perspective, CAGR of 6% over a number of years. That's the South African business, relatively similar trends internationally. And the market share happens to be also the same, 17.4%. I thought that might be a typo, but the team told me it isn't. So 17.4% for Premier. Obviously, it's different across different categories. We have a much higher market share in some categories than others within this space. And the growth here we see going forward being driven by increased urbanization and increasing South African middle class, plus health awareness and a broader product range. So we still believe that there's a growth outlook for this part of the business going forward. Turning to how Premier has performed within the millbag category, again, I won't go into all of this, but why do we believe in the Millbank sector? I think first and foremost, it's a defensive sector. It's value for money in terms of the product for consumers. And we believe there's a well-balanced demand and supply out there in the market. We don't think there's a much significant imbalance. We don't see that across our utilization of our portfolio. Secondly, you know, it's differentiated. The product is differentiated, and it's short-life product. It's not product that you can put on the shelves for 3-4 months. This is product that lasts 3-4 days on the shelves at most. And there are very, very high barriers to entry to get into this space, both from a CapEx perspective, a timing perspective, and also just a, quite frankly, a logistics perspective. And then the last one is there's a relatively low dependence on retailers. You know, one of the things about being in the FMCG space, there's lots of talk about the retailers. To be honest, when it comes to bread, retailers are important in our lives, and we have very strong and good relations with them. But particularly in the informal space, you know, that's where a significant amount, as I mentioned, 60% of our bread is sold in the informal space. If you look on the right-hand side of this chart, just showing the operational leverage, as I said, the market has grown by 7%, you know, over a period of time. Over the last 2 years, we've grown, you know, a CAGR of 15% in terms of our revenue, showing the market share gains that we've managed to get. And then the operational efficiencies are seen over the last 2 years, we've managed to increase our EBITDA not by 15%, but by 23%, again, by driving margins from 10% up to 12%. The last one, just quickly on this, on the Millbank slide, the only one really to focus on is in the middle there. You can see our market shares in the Western Cape. We've been number one as a 31% market share in that business with Blue Ribbon. We're a very strong number two, not far from number one in KZN with B&B. And in the Eastern Cape, we have a number of different brands, and we have about a 25% market share. We've recently done an infill acquisition in the Eastern Cape, which will add to that, and we're very confident that we will be moving up from number three, you know, going north. And the one that obviously stands out a bit is our inland business. We're a relatively distant number three, and that is why we spent the money on the Pretoria Bakery. Gauteng is 30% of the South African bread market, and we only constitute 12%. So to the extent we can continue to grow our market share through the Pretoria Bakery and consolidation of our operations there, you know, that will be significantly positive for our business. Just talking to, there's been a lot of chat in the markets around the ability of the business to pass on costs in an inflationary environment. We've gone back all the way back to March 2014, and all the way out, so that's whatever, an eight-year period to prove out the thesis that the business has managed over many, many years to increase its net sales per unit, as you can see in the blue chart on the left-hand side, at the same rate, if not higher, than the increase in the wheat price. So you can see there has been a very significant uptick in wheat prices over the last quarter in particular. And again, on the right-hand side, we've managed to retain and slightly grow our margins, which talks to the operating leverage in the business, despite over that eight-year period, obviously, volatility and increases in the wheat price. And then in the chart below, what we just tried to show is, you know, the blue and dark blue boxes are net sales realizations. Again, you can see an upward trend in that. And what's that a result of? It's a result of increasing margins. You can see that in the red line over that period of time as wheat prices have increased, and also, very importantly, volumes. So I think the important message is, you know, we do it very responsibly. We are extremely aware of the impact that this has on our consumer base. But we have been able to pass on price increases inputs through to the ultimate price. From a wheat perspective, from a cost of a loaf of bread, wheat constitutes around about 50% of a cost of a loaf of bread. So to give you some idea in terms of sensitivities, a 1,000 rand increase in the price of wheat, so call it going from 6,500 to 7,500, would add around 55 cents to the cost of a loaf. So, you know, you're talking about moving loaves from, you know, 16, 17 rand to 17 rand 50. You're not talking about moving rows from 15 rand to 25 rand. And I think that's an important distinction. Fuel is obviously important, but it costs only around, it represents only about 6% of the cost of a loaf. So from the outlook for this business, very pleasingly, since the beginning of this year, which is April and May, we've continued to see very strong growth in the business, which is pleasing. We've managed to achieve both volume growth in the Millbank business of, call it 9% in the last 2 months compared to the prior year. And then despite the significant cost pressures which have come through, as I mentioned, due to, you know, higher commodity prices, we've managed to see price growth of 10%. So, you know, it's early days. It's obviously a tough environment out there, But the good performance for the business didn't stop at the end of March. From an organic growth perspective, there's lots of opportunities to grow, whether that be M&A. We believe that in a weak environment like we're in today, consumers do downtrade. And to be honest, where do you downtrade to? You probably downtrade to bread and milling product, which is obviously where Premier plays. And we're starting to see the operational benefits and the integration of Mr. Sweet, which should enhance efficiencies going forward. From an M&A perspective, we continue to look at operations that will add value to the platform. There are many out there, but they need to fit with what we're trying to do in the business. And we think, once Mr. Sweet is bedded down, there are other operations that we will look at. From a CapEx perspective, there's been a long-term strategy of investing in the infrastructure of the business. That has continued with the circa 500 odd million we spent on Pretoria Bakery. And that should continue to grow our market share on the inland business, but probably more importantly, drive massive operational efficiencies compared to the six or seven other smaller operations that we had inland. So that sets the scene for Premier. We're very happy to take questions at the end. But in summary, a very strong performance. We see growth from here as well. The business, as I mentioned, is in a good state, and we are looking potentially to list this business, but we don't have any massive liquidity requirements to force it through. We will do it when it makes sense for the business and for our shareholders. Moving on to Virgin Active. Virgin Active, obviously, in a very different place. It's been an extremely tough year for Virgin Active. We've been through a restructuring, as I mentioned. The restructuring plan only completed in May, a number of refinancings, a capital raise. We've got a new management team on board. But all this is starting to manifest itself in a bit of positive momentum in the business. It's early days, so I don't want to get too excited, but you would have seen 12% growth in our membership base just since the last 5 months. That's a very big positive and a turnaround from where we were only 6 months ago. The restructuring in the European business, with cumulative cash benefit of about 134 million, really has set that business up to start a growth trajectory again, from a much more sensible liquidity position. We still think there's significant opportunities for the business to improve its membership engagement, enhance its digital and data strategies, and we'll talk a bit about that later on in the presentation. In terms of the capital raise, we raised £88 million, as you remember, at the back end of March, and very importantly, that was provided at the break valuation. I think it's a lot of people question the value that we put on the business. These are very sophisticated new investors who came into the business. They paid the same value that we valued the business at, and which showed, gave us confidence, but gave them confidence in that business as well. The new CEO, Dean Kowalski, who took over at the end of March, beginning of April, has done a great job shaking things up. We're very thankful and grateful to Matthew Bucknell, who was the CEO of this business and the founder for many, many years. It's been a seamless transition from Matthew to Dean, and we're seeing the new energy and enthusiasm that Dean is bringing to the business. And importantly, from a South African perspective, we've appointed a new MD about a week ago, Jessica Spira, an investment banking background. She worked actually with me at RMB, super talented lady, and it's great to see some female representation in an otherwise male-dominated sector. So Jessica will take over in the next couple of months, and she's got massive enthusiasm and some great ideas for the business going forward. From a break NAV perspective, it was up about 3.9%, call it 4%. But I think most importantly that valuation was underpinned by the recent capital raise. We'll talk a bit more in the presentation about, the overview of the market and what are the key value drivers in the sector, and also how our performance has played out relative to that and what our revised strategy looks like going forward. I won't dwell on this slide, but it does, again, spell out the numerous things that have been done for this business. A significant amount of work has been done to preserve liquidity, first and foremost, to restructure the business, put it back on an operational cost base that's more befitting of its growth profile, and to raise additional capital. And we genuinely believe we're starting to see the benefits of that, and we'll talk to that in the numbers going forward. Again, a quick overview of the transaction that was concluded in March. £88 million pounds was raised at the Virgin Active valuation of £949 million enterprise value. Existing shareholders capitalized the Virgin Active South Africa guarantee in exchange for shares. So there was a £950 million guarantee that had been provided by Brait and Virgin Group. We capitalized that and got shares for doing so. There was, as I mentioned, £88 million, 68 of which was from third-party investors, was injected into Virgin Active for shares. And then Virgin Active has acquired the nutritional assets of Real Foods in exchange for shares as well, and that should hopefully complete probably in the next, certainly in this quarter. From a perspective of ownership at the bottom, you can see the equity value at the time when we did the transactions, the 470 would be akin to the valuation you would have seen in September. 46 million in terms of the Virgin Active South Africa capitalization, 88 million the subscription for new shares, and then a 28 million will be the valuation of the amalgamation for the Real Foods business, and that ends up with an equity value of 634. So Brait's shareholding went from 80% of a business worth 470 to 67.4% of a business worth 634, which when you do the calculations means that it was an NAV neutral transaction for Brait. I won't touch too much on this slide other than say what are we going to do with the capital or what is already being done with the capital. The 88 million will be used obviously to provide liquidity support where required, particularly in the European business, to rejuvenate the estate, which is required both in South Africa, but probably some places of the UK as well, to invest in our sales and marketing and to drive new sales and improve acquisition channels, and then obviously to drive the product offering, and we'll talk a bit about that in our strategy, and finally, from a digital and technology perspective. The amalgamation of the Real Foods deal, why did we do it? We think it adds a huge new bow to the arrow of this business, particularly around moving it to a wellness business. As you can see at the bottom, we really believe that combining nutrition and fitness will help our members achieve their wellness and goals much more effectively. And also from a data perspective, having significant data on a new, you know, lots of new customers can only be positive for both businesses. Right, let's talk a bit about the various businesses. In terms of the total group business, year-to-date membership recovery is up 12% since the beginning of January. These are active members I talk about. As you can see on the top chart, South Africa moved from having 497,000 active members to 557, so 70% of the 2019 membership base up to 78%, which is a positive. From a European perspective, they moved from having 257,000 members up to 290, particularly after a dip in late December, January. So that has been a very positive build-up from 67% of 2019 levels to 73%. So if you look on the right-hand side, what's happened from December to May, we've moved from 69% to 75% as a percentage of 2019 members. 800,000 members before is now up at 871 in terms of closing members, and a significant amount of those have been members that have moved off freeze. Freeze are those members who don't pay. They remain as a member, but they don't pay. As you can see, that's moved from 6% down to 2.8%. But very importantly, if you look at the bottom, just to give you some indication, we'll talk about each of the territories separately. But to give you an idea of this is year-to-date group sales net of termination. So if you sell 100 and you lose 20, that would be 80. 65,000 in the first 5 months compares to 23,000, nearly three times the amount in terms of net additions compared to 2019. So genuinely, there is some positive momentum back in the business, but there is still a very long way to go. I'll touch briefly on the South African business, focusing on the right-hand side. As I mentioned, they're up to 78% of their 2019 levels, a relatively small number on freeze, although you must remember in South Africa, the freeze concept didn't exist before, so that number used to be zero, and we would hopefully work that number to zero over time. About 12% increase in the last 5 months in terms of memberships. And as you can see, the terminations there, or the net additions there, of 46,000 compared to circa 13,000 in 2019 is nearly fourfold higher than it was in 2019. From a break-even perspective, the business currently has 565,000 total members, and the break-even total membership is 524. So it's a positive contributor both to cash flows and to EBITDA. Moving on to the UK, the UK has had a very strong run. When we opened up post-December, Omicron had a massive impact, as you can see, if you look at the numbers from sort of September to December. But since December, at the end of December, 107,000 members has grown to 120, also about 12% growth. The business is back to about 70% of 2019 levels. And with about just under 6% of its members on freeze, I would say the average over three or four years in this business pre-COVID was probably closer to 3 to 4%. So again, you know, some work to be done on those members. But again, from a net additions perspective, bottom right, you can see almost again, not quite a threefold, maybe it's 2.5-fold increase compared to 2019. If I had to say which businesses are doing well, the residential clubs have recovered very well. They're operating at somewhere between, it's probably closer now to 90% of 2019 levels, whilst the central London clubs, a bit like our peers in the London market, are still at around 70% odd of 2019 levels. Importantly, total membership is at about 127,000, which is slightly below the break-even for this business of 133,000 members required. Again, very similar on Italy, you know, growth from 106 to 123. The difference here is that we only really saw the restrictions lifted at the back end of March in Italy. Sales progression since then has been very, very good and very strong. We've opened up a number of two new clubs in this market. Both have been significantly taken up. So I think that's a significant positive. If you take our total membership of 129,000 members, it's obviously still below the break-even of 141, but the progression towards those numbers are positive. As you can see, we increased our active membership base by 16% over the last 5 months. I won't dwell much on the Asia-Pacific. It's a much smaller part of the business. It's remained closed. As you see at the top, there are still massive restrictions, particularly across Singapore and Thailand. Australia has opened up, but we have the same issue that we have in London there with our inner-city gyms performing less well. But we are starting to see that turn. The numbers are starting to look better. Look, it's a small part of the overall business, but it's got quite a long way to get back to a break-even contribution to the overall group. From a strategy perspective, you know, we spent a huge amount of time with Dean and the new team just looking back and saying, you know, how did the business perform and what do we need to do differently? Just to remind people, this business made £142 million of EBITDA in 2019. It made cumulative cash flows of £309 million over 5 years. These are pounds. And it has a 22% EBITDA margin, this business. And this is the group. Obviously, South Africa is significantly higher than that. So from a perspective on the right of our previous strategy, what was good about the business? I mean, clearly it's got a significant footprint. State-of-the-art clubs in Italy and Asia-Pacific. The South African clubs have an extremely strong market share, but do require some rejuvenation. And we were really at the end of the repositioning of the UK property portfolio just as COVID came. We'd sold off a number of our provincial clubs. We had a potential opportunity to do further downsizing there, and obviously that was interrupted by COVID. In terms of the revisions to strategy, what do we need to do differently? We need to move from being a bricks and mortar only business to offering digital. We've done that, but I think we need to up our game on the digital side. We need to invest much more in the member experience in certain geographies, and particularly in South Africa. It's not up to speed with what the rest of the world does, and we need to get it there, and we need to get it there relatively quickly. We need to expand it to multiple sales channels. At the moment, you can only come in really, to be honest, to the club to join up. Most people these days never go to a club to join up. They need to do it online, and we've got the systems in place, hopefully to open that up in the next 2 to 3 months to enable ourselves to do that. And that has come with investment in the IT platforms and systems, particularly around data and digital. Understanding your customers better, personalization are all the themes, and we need to get that right with an investment in IT. We need a much more flexible pricing model. I think we've been fixated in the past about having 12-month contracts and the benefits that has. I do think we've moved to a more flexible model, but we continue to refine that and improve it and ensure that we can continue to engage our customers better. And then the last one is an increased focus on return on invested capital. You know, one, certainly maybe my issue, I don't think this business has spent enough time focusing on getting the requisite return on its invested capital and being more circumspect about where to spend its money. There's lots of great opportunities, but we need to go through the smorgasbord and decide which of those we're actually going to do and get a return on capital for shareholders. Just in terms of the overall wellness industry, you know, there have been a number of commentators in the market who said that, you know, the physical activity or the wellness space was dead. I think when we talk about wellness, we don't just talk about physical activity. If you look at the left-hand side of that box, you know, it's a $4.4 trillion market, according to Global Wellness Institute, who are unpaid. So this is their own views. They're not paid to provide these views. But if you look at next to the physical activity box, actually healthy eating, nutrition, weight loss, et cetera, is a much bigger part of the market than physical activity. So our first foray into that is obviously Real Foods, but there's many other options to do that and to improve our offering to members So as we say, whilst physical activity contributes less than 20% of the wellness economy, where do we continue to play and look to play to continue to grow this business? So it's not just about physical real estate. There's lots of other things. On the right-hand side, again, GWI project that the wellness economy will grow at, call it 10% over the next 5 years. Now, maybe they're wrong, but I think what the research they've done is it's certainly not a business that many commentators called 12 months ago in perpetual decline. And interesting, as part of that, physical activity is one of the ones that's likely to grow, you know, slightly ahead of the average at 10.2%. So again, I think we're extremely well positioned as a brand, as a business that has lots of operations in key countries that continue to grow. We need to be able to combine the left-hand side of this chart with the right-hand side and find ourselves a place to play in the wellness space. Again, we've looked at a lot of, we've done a lot of work, and I won't spend time on this, on what are the key gym industry trends? What are our competitors doing? What are our customers asking for? And, you know, very simply, it's about community. It's about wanting to go to a gym, you know, create a community outside of the home so that people want to go there and an experience. The second is digital. You need to be able to provide people with the ability to come into gym, but also to do their classes at home. Now, we're a long way down the line there, but having a combination of what we call digital, we definitely think will distinguish you from the rest. Having a diverse offering, and I think this really talks to our group exercise classes, our personal trainers, having a hybrid model that gets people outside of the house to come there. Why? Because they've got something to go to, someone to go to, someone to push them. That will get people coming back to the gym, and that reduces churn. Personalization is an absolute key trend in this market. We need to get it right. We need to get our data right so that we can talk to our customers better and improve the membership engagement, and we're a long way down the line to being able to do that. And the next start of that would be to develop, and we are developing an app which will give us the ability to do that. And then there's overall wellness, which is exactly what I talked to. This is not just about physical gym work. It's about, you know, physical, nutrition, mental health, and how do you retain your savvy members from other than just offering them a treadmill to come and run on. And then the last one is sustainability. It talks to the ESG trends I mentioned at the beginning. It's absolutely key to the business. Ethical and sustainable products and services are absolutely something that our growing younger membership base are demanding. From a strategy perspective, these are the bones of the strategy that have been developed. And again, I won't dwell on it. I'll leave you to it. But there's probably six key strategic levers. The first is to improve the product offering. I mentioned that we need to get the product offering better. It's fantastic in the UK. It's very good in Italy. And it's substandard in South Africa. We need to improve it. We need to get tech improvements to enhance the membership experience. I've talked a bit to that already. And then we need to spend CapEx on rejuvenating the estate. The look and feel, you want to come to a place that looks fresh, new, and rejuvenates the membership base as well. The app development, online sales, you know, digital, personalization, all of those things are caught up in the app, and we need to get that done and finished as soon as possible. We've talked about flexible membership options and then having a holistic wellness strategy. Those are the strategic levers. We've talked about the enablers. It's data, it's apps, it's leveraging the partnerships we have. We have a fantastically supportive partnership with Vitality, but there's other partners that we can continue to work with. And one of the most important enablers for me is the capital allocation, ensure that we don't waste money where it's not going to give us a return. And then importantly, it's well and good talking about strategic levers. I always say that's interesting, but where does it manifest itself? And so just again running through it, you know, the product and operations. If we get that right, what will happen? We will reduce churn. We will generate ancillary revenues from enhanced product offerings. So that's the nub of this whole thing from a product perspective. Technology, again, growing sales, reducing terminations, having more personalization, all of that will talk to our membership experience. And if we get that right, we will increase the customer lifetime value, which is absolutely the key metric for this business. Capital allocation, again, just talks to which clubs should we keep, which clubs do we need to negotiate with the landlords and say, guys, if we don't get the right deal, we're not in this for the long term, and where do we need to invest in new clubs? The online offering, you know, that really talks to increasing our engagement levels. We've seen it already. Usage levels are up significantly from 6 months ago, but we need to continue to drive to lower the customer acquisition costs. We need a model which can get people in there without having to pay very significant commissions to a sales force. And then the last ones are flexible membership models. Obviously, that just talks to what our members want. Can we create a product and also a structure that gets the people back into the gym? And then integrating that with food and fitness, you know, is exactly what we're talking about doing with respect to the Real Foods business. How are things going? Again, on this slide, in terms of the outlook, what's been pleasing to see is how relatively quickly. I don't know how quickly that is, but quickly moving from, you know, December of 69%, we've moved up to 75% in terms of active members. And on the right-hand side, you can see how that manifests itself in a very significant 45% increase from a year ago in terms of the quarterly revenue. I've always said this is a massively operationally leveraged business. You have the same fixed cost base. Every single member that you get in is effectively marginal profit or reducing your marginal loss. But and we've seen a 45% increase from 64 to 93 over the last year. And again, it's pleasing to see that that's across all territories. You know, this hasn't been one particular territory. It really has been across the lot. We get a lot of questions, quite rightly, from our investors saying, yeah, but what does all this mean from a perspective of how much money should the business make? What have we tried to show here is, on the top left, we show the performance in 2019 for the group. So as I mentioned there, 134, the reason that's different to the 140 you saw earlier is because of the exchange rate we've used here. We've used the current exchange rate. But this gives you an idea. The group made about 134 million. It invested about 70 million, of which 25 was new clubs. So call it 45 million of maintenance capex, which gives you a free cash flow of somewhere between, call it 52, and if you add 25 back to that, somewhere 75 million pounds a year. The fixed versus variable cost base absolutely changes by territory. So we've got one of these for all the territories. But to give you an idea here, if you look at the split, it's 30% variable and 70% fixed, broadly, as an average. What have we then done is we said, look, if we take our 2022 cost base, we apply this fixed versus variable, and all you change at the top is your percentage of 2019 membership base, and on the left-hand side, your yield. That will give you an idea. It'll spit out a number based on 2022's costs of what the business should make from an EBITDA perspective. So where are we today? Current membership levels, as I mentioned, 75% of 2019 membership base. Call it a 2% yield increase over 2019, would suggest that on current run rate, the business should make 25-odd million pounds. To get back to the 110, which we use in our valuations, would require us to get back to just short of 95% with a yield increase of somewhere between 2 and 3%, that somewhere between 108 and 112 is 110. And then to get back to where we were in 2019, coincidentally means that we need to get back to 100%. Obviously, the costs are different. We've taken costs out of the business. There have been some escalations. But if we get back to the same cost base, same membership base we had in 2019, we're currently 75, if we get back to 100, we will make the same profitability in this business that we made historically. Then let's just move on to New Look. As I know, New Look is a smaller part of the business, so we'll talk about this in the, you know, quicker. I understand we're running shortish of time. But again, New Look, from one year to the next, has had a very significantly positive performance. I think we were disappointed because it had a very poor third quarter there. October to December quarter was poor, along with all the other retailers in the UK. But if you look at revenue year on year, it was up 58%. We made £875 million. It's a substantial business. It grew very significantly year on year. From an EBITDA perspective, it turned from a loss of £34 million to a positive £25 million. It was less than we had hoped for sure, but certainly it's a £59 million turnaround from the year before. Cash remains at £84 million. Again, when we had to do the recapitalization, it was because there wasn't cash in the business, so that's a very big positive. From a retail perspective, the retail business was significantly impacted in the third quarter, the festive quarter. It wasn't just Omicron, which was huge, but obviously supply chain issues. And again, we'll touch on a bit later. We had our own internal issues as well. They weren't only exogenous factors. From an online perspective, up a massive 46% on pre-COVID levels, and now constitutes nearly 30% of revenues from less than 10 two, 3 years ago. It's been a fantastic performance, and I do think the management deserve the credit. The business has still got a number one market share in women's dresses and denim. And very interestingly, we started a concession stores business with Asda, a trial with Asda, which has gone fantastically well. We're looking to further grow that with Asda, but also potentially with other partners. And it's been a significant third leg to the business, which we didn't have probably 12 months ago. Importantly, the start to the year has been positive and probably even more positive since the so if you take the calendar year, the first 3 months or the last 3 months of the year were good for the business. And importantly, April and May have been a relatively strong above-budget months for this business going forward. In terms of the, you know, like-for-like, again, I'm not going to dwell much on this. As I mentioned, there were supply chain, Omicron, and inflation issues. We are starting to see the impacts of inflation in this market. Consumers obviously are not, you know, they are impacted by it. We do play into a lower end category, which to some extent, if down trading happens, is to our benefit. But clearly, we are starting to see the benefit, I mean, the impact that it's had. But from a retail and e-commerce perspective, I think both parts of the business, whilst we could do better in many cases, and we'll look at a slide coming up as to what we are going to do, is starting to look very positive for the business. Talking a bit about what are we going to do with the business, as I said, there's two key things that we need to get right. The first is the revenue mix, and we've really got three avenues for revenue. The first is own stores, and we're looking very carefully at where do you want to be, where do you want to own stores, in which locations, and what value do they add to the rest of your business, particularly the online business. As I mentioned, the next is the UK concession stores, which we've got with Asda, significant growth that we didn't have a year ago. We're looking to see, is that something we can roll out? And it's starting to look like it's something that could be very successful for the business. And then finally, online. Online's done fantastically well. We do need to get moved from a business that was only a retail business, you know, bricks and mortar, to one that now has online. We do need to make sure from a distribution center perspective on the right-hand side that we do two things. Firstly, that we get our costs befitting of an omni-channel business, and we're looking very significantly at that. And then obviously improvements that we need to continue to make in our DCs, which will require some investment to improve our operational capacity and flexibility. So there's lots on the go. The management team is working hard here, but it's been a good start to the year. Then moving on to what everyone really wants to know, which is how do you value these businesses? From a Premier perspective, relatively simple. We've kept the valuation methodology exactly the same. What we've tried to show here, I think Shabella alluded to it, we've moved from a pre-IFRS accounting to post-IFRS. And the reason for that is all of our peers, in the form of Tiger, AVI, RFG, all report on a post-IFRS basis. So if you look at the pre-IFRS basis, what would this business have made on a pre-IFRS basis? It would have made $1.4 billion compared to the $1.152 that it made a year ago. We always valued this business at an 8x multiple. If we had valued the same business, this business at an 8x multiple, it would have an enterprise value of $11,241. The net debt would have been $1,760. Would have given you a valuation of 6198. If you look on the right-hand side, we've moved to a post-IFRS basis. Very importantly, starting at the bottom, it doesn't change the valuation. So the valuation at the bottom starts with 6198. If you move your way up, the net debt is slightly higher, obviously because of the IFRS adjustment, but your EBITDA is correspondingly slightly higher. So what does that do? All we've changed is we've changed the multiple from 8x to 7.6. That's a back solve to ensure that we end up with the same valuation. How does that 7.6x compare with the peer groups? As you can see, Tiger Brands trading at 8.3, AVI at 8.3, and the average at 7.7. So we've traded a slight discount to that. And just to give you some idea of the two-year CAGR for EBITDA, you know, we can see our peers, Tiger Brands at minus 11, AVI broadly flat, RFG just above flat, and we've grown over that 2 years at a rate of 20% per annum. And on the right-hand side, probably the most important metric being a return on invested capital. I think despite having invested very heavily in this business, 5 billion rand over the last 10 years, we've got our return on invested capital up to nearly 15%. From a Virgin Active perspective, the methodology is exactly the same. We've taken a 2-year forward to EBITDA. That's based on our current management accounts, would suggest that EBITDA in 31st of March 2024 would be 110. We've kept the multiple the same. If you look down the table there, the net debt is reduced from 422 to 353, call it about a 70 million reduction, largely due to the £88 million that we injected into the business. Obviously, there's been some cash burn over that six-month period as well. The deferred costs, these are costs, license fees and other operating costs that we've deferred during lockdown. It's gone down from 34 to 27, so they're still out there. We've accounted for that as if they were in the debt today. And that gives you a shareholder value of 610 and a surplus equity value of 561. Importantly, we are now 70-odd% shareholder in this business, down from 80-odd, 79 I think it was. But as I say, it's a bigger business with the cash injected in. The deal was done at our rates in it carrying value for Virgin Active, and I think that gave both us and the auditors a lot of confidence that this valuation has got some credibility. From a multiples perspective, again, the peer average is around 10. Yeah, some are lower, some are higher. That's obviously an average. We've applied a 10% discount to that and retained the same 9x at the bottom. Moving on to New Look. New Look, again, very similar valuation. We use a 12-month forward which is how the market values these businesses, particularly in the UK. We've kept the maintainable EBITDA at a similar level to what it was in September. The multiple is the same. And if you work your way down, the valuation is up on March last year, so up from 545 to 672, but actually slightly down from September. And again, they're largely because the net debt is slightly up in the business. Again, from a perspective of where the peers trade, the average is 6.7. We apply about a 25% discount to that to get back to our valuation. And then just the last slide, we get asked a lot of questions around how are we going to monetize value in this business. We genuinely believe we've got some great assets in Premier. We've got a great asset in Virgin. And New Look is definitely an option value for us that actually could end up being a very fortuitous option that we have in the business. How are we looking at this? And this is, we have now got the board to sign off on our ethos-led exit strategy for the various businesses. Let's start with the first one, which is the listing of Premier. Despite market commentators thinking it is certainly not off, we intend to list this business. We don't need to be in a rush to list this business. But I've always said that listing a business is 30% about how the business itself is performing and 70% about how the market is performing. We need the market to settle down, to be quite frank, but that can happen in a matter of weeks. We are ready to press the button. We don't need to press the button, and we will continue to monitor it. And when the time is right, we intend to list this business. And we said, yeah, look to sell down, let's say, a 30% stake. Those proceeds would be used to fully settle the RCF and leave cash in the business for operating costs. If you then move down further down the line, that could happen, as I mentioned, any time over the next 12 months. It could happen very soon. It could happen in 12 months' time. We have the full optionality around that. What we would see coming towards the back end of or middle of 24 is potential sale of the New Look business at that point in time. Hopefully it's fully recovered with its EBITDA closer to what we think is a sustainable long-term level. If we could sell that business, it might require us to sell a bit of our residual stake in Premier, and that would enable us to repay the convertible bond in cash to the extent it hasn't already converted. We don't think the convertible bond will necessarily convert at the current prices. Its exchange price is 10 Rand a share from where we are today, but it might, in which case we wouldn't need any further cash. But if it wasn't, we would settle the convertible bond in cash. That would give us full optionality on the basis that the exchangeable bond will have exchanged into Brait shares to unbundle the Premier shares, whatever remains of the Premier shares, call it 50, 60, 70%, and the Virgin Active shares to Brait shareholders. That would, in a one fell swoop, get rid of any discount to NAV. We currently trade at a 50% discount to NAV. And again, if you assume relatively small, modest growth of, call it 10 to 12, 13% growth in NAV over the next 3 years, and you then unbundle everything to investors, the share price should triple from where it is today. That is the strategy. That's what we've agreed with the board, and that's what we will work to conclude. Thank you very much, and we're very happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now be conducting a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your telephone keypad or the keypad on your screen. For the benefit of the participants who have connected via the webcast, you're welcome to post your questions in the question box provided on your screen. The first question comes from Maran Rajaratnam of MIPFA.
Good afternoon, and hi, Peter. Thanks for the opportunity to ask questions. I've got three. I'll ask them one by one. The first question I have is on slide 21 on Millbake. If you have a look at that slide, on the top right, you show the CAGR bread sales performance over 7 years, but in five actual and two forecasts, but 7%. What would be Premier's Millbake revenue and EBITDA over the five-year period, for example? You know, your sort of longer-term investors like to see what five-year view might be.
Sure. Ross, you have the exact number to hand. I don't have the number to hand. It would look good. That's the only thing I would say. But I'll be honest. Sorry, I just don't have the number to hand. I can definitely try and get it for you. There's absolutely nothing to hide. It's just that I haven't shown it. I don't have it, is the honest answer.
Fair enough.
But I would suggest it's above the 7%.
Sure. You know, as buy-siders, you know, we're a slow-moving bunch, and we're normally cautious about IPOs. Even the old bugger, Benjamin Graham, said, watch out for IPOs, right? You know, because it's an asymmetry of information, Peter, right? And there's precedent recently. I mean, in the last 5-7 years, there was a listing of a food company that's currently still listed, and specifically listed out of, it was a private equity deal as well. You know, they listed it, and that wasn't much of a success. So I suppose my question is, how do you give us some comfort, Peter, that, you didn't, and especially if you look at that last EBITDA number, FY22 versus FY21, that was a proper growth, right? I mean, how do you give us some comfort? And, sometimes you have to explain it slowly to buy-siders like me, right? How do you give us comfort that, you didn't cut costs to the bone and, how they say it in English, you didn't dress the turkey up for Christmas?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. And I think there's two ways to answer the question. The first is, and the most important, guys, is that we're not selling out. We will be picking up a 70-odd% shareholder as Brait. I would suggest and I would hope that a lot of our investors that buy into the IPO would actually probably be our existing investors as well, right? They know the assets well. So we are not selling out. We intend to unbundle the rest of the shares to our shareholders. So there's no, there's no short-term game here where we can sell it to someone else, walk into the sunset with a ton of cash. Yes, we are selling down to provide some liquidity at a break level, but genuinely, and I say this absolutely genuinely, we are long-term holders of the asset. We will lock ourselves up for an extended period of time because we are longer-term owners of the asset. We intend to, as per my strategy slide, unbundle the shares to shareholders. So I think that's the first one, which is the biggest mitigant, quite frankly. The second is on, yes, the performance has been strong, but the performance has started strongly over the last couple of months as well, and it's been over a pretty lengthy period of time. I suggest we've outperformed the market for 3-4 years, and that comes from having invested in this business over a very long period of time. As I mentioned, $5 billion over 10 years, even for you buy-side guys, 10 years is the longest time, right? So, we've been investing in this business, we've been improving it, and we're starting to see the benefits of that. Like the Mr. Sweet deal, we don't see the synergies in this year's numbers. In fact, we've only consolidated 10 months. We definitely see benefits there. We see other add-ons that we can make to the business. So there's still lots of runway to grow. And then from a, from a CapEx perspective, that's the way I would look at it. Private equity is notorious for not spending money on a business before it brings it to market or sells it. If I say, that's what Mr. Benjamin would tell you, I'm sure. You go back and look and compare our, what we say, EBITDA over DNA. So effective, CapEx over EBITDA, let's say. Whatever metric you want to look at, we have spent a huge amount more money than any of our peers over a very significant period of time. And I think that's what differentiates us. And that is different from a normal private equity, sell this thing. I think genuinely, Brait was never a private equity vehicle. It was a long-term owner of these assets. And I think credit to them, long before we came around as Ethos, they've invested in this portfolio and the management have done a good job. So I think the two things. One, we're not selling out. We're going to be a long-term holder and we'd be locked up to show that, right? And secondly, that if you go back in history, this has been a long progression of performance coming through. And I think we spend much, much more on the business than any of our peers, which is why we're starting to see the benefits of that.
Great. My last question is on slide 47, if I can. It's where you value Premier, right? I suppose my question is the multiple you guys use. I mean, I'm looking at the top right-hand chart. You use 7.5, right? Is it fair to compare it against something like AVI, with its quite diversified categories of goods and portfolio, right? And even Tiger Brands, given its it's half of it's similar to you guys, and the other half is, everyday branded goods, right, consumer goods. The reason I'm asking is, this is a good time for bread at the moment for some of the players there. But if there is a bread war, for example, some of the risks in the Premier model is not reflected in that multiple because it's a commoditized product. If there's a risk of a bread war, right, 80% of your profits come from one, bread and wheat, right, whereas and flour. And whereas, these other companies have a much more diversified portfolio and very little debt. So I'm just thinking, and I know EV, but there are multiples take care of the debt, but is it fair to compare it to these guys is my question, I suppose. Thanks, Peter.
Yeah, look, it's a very good question, and there's no right answer, right? Everyone's going to have a view. I mean, we have taken, we've been consistent about how we valued it, and just so that you're aware, we currently value ourselves on this basis here at a 10% discount to both Tiger and AVI. I mean, Tiger's growth historically has been, let's say, not great. Its return on invested capital gone from 15 or 16 down to 11. And even AVI's performance over the last, you know, growth over the last year hasn't been stellar. And if you look at its investment in new capacity and its existing capacity, it's been very low, which is why its return on invested capital is so high. Okay. So we've also taken a lot of advice from advisors, as you can imagine, and I was a banker, so I can knock them, but you know, a lot of clever bankers telling us what they think. We've got three different bankers working with us, all of you corroborated our view on value. We have auditors who sign off on it. So yes, it's an eye of the beholder. We look at a couple of things. We look at growth, you know, what's our performance on growth historically, but also going forward. We look at return on invested capital as a key metric, and then you look at longer term trends in margin, right? And then I think you compare all of that to what was the long term average EV EBITDA multiple. And I think the sector is trading probably 20 to 25% below the long-term average. I'd be a bit more worried if we were trading at 25% above the long-term average, but we're not. So taking all that into account and applying a 10% discount to Tiger and AVI, who I think have underperformed, I don't think is wrong. Look, the best way to value these businesses on a DCF basis, and which we do, and I think all of our advisors do, and I think that solves back to a number which is obviously at a premium to these levels. So look, I can't say we're right. I would suggest that we are confident at this level. Our advisors are confident and our auditors are confident. So, but as you mentioned, there's lots of things that need to go into it. A price war can happen at any point in time. You know, we've been through one. I think it talks to operational efficiency. Those who are the lowest cost producer will be the best placed in any potential price war. And right now that's us.
Great. Thank you so much, Peter.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, just a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, you're welcome to press star and then one. At this stage, we have no further questions on the lines. I will now hand over the questions from the webcast.
Yeah, so there's one, Charles Wells from Titanium. Thanks, Charles. Slide 41 indicates that if Virgin Active membership gets back to 2019 levels at 100%, with a 3% yield, EBITDA would get back to 2019 levels. Why is there no benefit from the costs that have been taken out in the restructuring? I think if you take, what are we comparing? We're comparing a profit in 2019 to a profit in 2022. And Charles, with all the best will in the world, despite the costs that we've taken out, and they have been significant, you know, the inflation across, whether it be staff, whether it be energy costs, whether it be, you know, even leases, in, particularly in the South African context, that would probably get our costs back to flat, which is why the number is exactly the same. So despite having taken out very significant costs, I think 3 years of inflation in the other product lines, you know, have obviously eaten into that. So the fact that we've been able to effectively keep costs flat over a three-year period, despite inflation being, you know, in many cases north of 5, 6, 7%, you know, I think that's why the numbers are the same. The next question is from Pierre Borski from HBK. How much CapEx was deducted from Premier net debt? When do you expect the Pretoria Bakery to become EBITDA positive? Ralph, do you have the answer to, I mean, it's in there.
Yeah. So I think the CapEx deduction from net debt was about 370 million. And the deduction for that is because the asset hasn't started contributing EBITDA in these results. So it's consistent with prior years. In terms of EBITDA positive, so the first line is in operation in March, and the second line will come in July. We would expect it to start contributing immediately and start making cost savings. We've already closed one of the bakeries in Middelburg, so that'll start generating the cost savings upon which the investment return is predicated. So I think it'll generate returns starting this year when
both lines are in full production.
Thanks, Rolf. Next question from Nick Kricher at Signal. There are rumors in the market that Brakes has approached institutions about listing Premier, and there's been soft appetite for the IPO. Can you comment, please? Premier's results were very good, and I guess there's some disappointment that the IPO was not announced today. I can absolutely categorically say that that's not right. Nick, we have not approached any investors. We went around in, I think, and I'm going to say February, on a soft-sounding basis to introduce the management team to investors. I would say that it was unanimously positive, the feedback from investors, and since then we haven't been to investors. The reason for not announcing it today, look, when I say we absolutely done, there's still certain things that need to be done. I would say But we're in very short order ready to do it. There's no rush, Nick, at the end of the day. I know there's some maybe disappointment, but we need to monitor when is the right time to go out and do it. And it's not because you want to eke out the best, absolutely best price for this thing, but you do want to launch an IPO in a relatively positive market generally. So I would suggest we have a finger above the button. We can press it at any time, and we're going to do it in a responsible manner when the time is right. There's no need to rush and do it. But I can absolutely categorically say there's been no feedback from investors, certainly that I've heard, that would suggest that they're not positive. The next question, how do Premier plan to gain market share in Gauteng? Are you prepared to use price to gain market share, or is it about enhancing distribution to gain share? So again, and Rolf alluded to it, when we pressed the button on the Pretoria Bakery, it absolutely wasn't around market share growth. We could get an 18% return, Rolf, I'm looking at maybe 17, 18% IRR on the business through operating efficiencies. So let me repeat, even if we didn't get one single share above our 12 or 13% in the Gauteng market, the operating efficiency you get from having an integrated Millbake business would give us a circa 17% return. That was the base which we pressed the button. Would we hope to gain market share? Of course we would hope to gain market share. The quality of our bread has improved, moving from 12 to 20. Would we use price to do that? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. We're not in that game, right? We're going to price our product appropriately so that it sells. We've got long-term customer relations that we need to monitor. But are we going after market share in this market? No. What we need to do is do it responsibly. We see growth in the market, and we see our ability to grab some market share, but it's not driven by predatory pricing that's going to get us there.
Anything else, Ray?
I think that's the last of the questions that we have. Are there any others on the line?
No, sir. We have no further questions on the lines.
Sorry, I've got one more. Can you please provide the exact dates when the IPO windows for Premier is open? Look, it's a long, how long you got, right? The window is really driven by the results go stale from an international marketing perspective after a period of time post your results being audited. So, for example, our March year-end results, you could probably go till the end of September-ish, without having to re-audit those accounts. If you want, at the date of September, you can re-audit your accounts and then you're good to go again. So the windows are open to us. You just need to do different things at a certain point in time. If you wanted to press a button in November, you would need to audit, for example, the mid-year results of Premier. But from now till, I would say, broadly September, that window is open from a perspective. It's also driven by when are the international institutions at their desk. As we all know, those guys seem to go away for 2 months over August and September. And if we want to get international demand, you obviously want them at their desk. So it's partly driven by the audited numbers going stale and partly driven by when's the best time to tap investors both locally and internationally. That's the only questions I have. Thank you very much for your participation. We really appreciate it. And as I've always said, please feel free to reach out if there's any further questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's event. Thank you for joining us. You may now disconnect your lines.